From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Where in the world is Mark Zuckerberg? Well, lately, everywhere. This week, he was seen facing off against Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in congressional hearings.
I mean, if you're not fact-checking political advertisements, I'm just trying to understand the bounds here. What's fair game?
Congresswoman, I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head.
Last week, he was at Georgetown University giving a speech on free expression.
Now I'm committed to the values that we're discussing today, but well, we won't always get it right.
He's also come up in coverage of the Democratic presidential campaign.
Pete Buttigieg's campaign confirmed that Zuckerberg and his wife, Priscilla Chan, recommended staffers to the campaign.
And he was heard in leaked audio published by The Verge this month, offering his opinion of another presidential candidate.
Like Elizabeth Warren, your fix of the right answers to break up the companies.
With the usually elusive and mostly silent Zuckerberg front and center this week, did we learn anything new?
I mostly learned that Congress has gotten way better at asking questions to Mark Zuckerberg than the last time they did in the Senate hearing in April of 2018.
Kate Klonick is assistant professor at St. John's Law School, where she's researching the creation of an oversight board at Facebook. She watched most of the proceedings on the Hill, and she also saw the Georgetown address, where Zuckerberg articulated his views about Facebook and free speech.
I had this moment of, why is he explaining the First Amendment and American free speech values to this crowd of American college-age students, until I realized that he was explaining it to the rest of the world. He was live streaming it on Facebook, and there were hundreds of thousands of people all over the globe tuning in. And so I think that that's kind of how you have to think about his attempts at explaining freedom of expression.
Well, putting aside his claims to Democratic nobility, there was also some revisionist history that had to be dealt with. I mean, this is a business that began with college students rating the relative hotness of other college students. But he seems to remember it as something different, the epicenter of debate about the war in Iraq.
And the toll on soldiers and their families and our national psyche was severe, yet most of us felt like we were powerless to do anything about it. And I remember feeling that if more people had a voice to share their experiences, then maybe it could have gone differently.
Now, it wouldn't be surprising for someone to exaggerate the origin story, except the origin story of Facebook was a hit movie that millions and millions of people have seen.
We're ranking girls.
You mean other students?
Yeah.
You think this is such a good idea?
I need the algorithm.
All right.
I need the algorithm.
The social network where, you know, which didn't have anything to do with the free market of ideas. What's he up to?
Yeah, I mean, there was one moment in the hearing that I thought was significant. I mean, it was just kind of silly banter from a congressman, but I said, did you ever think that you'd have started this like back in the day? And of course he didn't, because no one in their right mind imagined a world like this, or very few people did. It has completely rewritten how people communicate globally, how we form communities, how we speak to our leaders, how we vote, how we shop, every aspect of our community, right? And so it's not crazy to me that he's kind of had this revisionist history of how it all started, because he's trying to grapple with the realities of how large and how powerful the company that he's created is and how powerful it is as a tool. That said, that could have been like a personal journey for him. I don't understand the point of giving like a speech about it or deciding that you're going to wrap in the current events of the time. I mean, maybe that was something that was going on in the back of his head, but you're right. There have been multiple biographies and multiple movies and all of these things that involve this, and they didn't involve that part of the story.
On the subject of reframing, his whole speech at Georgetown seemed to try to reframe his company's image from that of a cynical, highly profitable operation to the fullest expression of democratic nobility and bulwark against tyranny and evil. As Kara Swisher observed in the Times this week, he seems to be saying you can have Facebook, or you can be China. Is that how you heard it?
I didn't see it as kind of an ultimatum, let's put it that way. But I did see him as telling people that this is part of the global struggle that is happening right now, which is that you have giant tech platforms like Facebook and Twitter and Google that are built out of American free speech norms, that are built out of democratic ideals, that have developed in that worldview for the last 15 years. And then you have China. That part of it is kind of accurate. But I do think that he was trying to kind of put the poles in the ground of where the debate could go. And I actually think it's really great because I think people lose sight of that. I think we kind of get acculturated in the U.S. to pushing back on these platforms. And we don't realize that in the global South, in a lot of places, Facebook is the internet. And Facebook has democratized a lot of speech and been a force, sometimes for good, sometimes for evil, but certainly changed people's access to knowledge and information.
Understood. Although as long as we're talking about places where democracy is not as firmly entrenched as it is in North America, it doesn't take too much to imagine a situation in which a policy of not fact-checking political ads and giving them even more leeway than other kinds of speech could go very, very wrong.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Yeah.
Like Myanmar deadly pogrom wrong, right?
Oh, completely. Yep. And I think this is probably one of the scariest points of the last few weeks has been the release by Facebook of their community standards. There were two changes. One was not particularly huge. They just announced it publicly, which was that political figures were exempted from the community standards that bind the rest of us so they could say things like hate speech on the platform and it would stay up. That was actually not a huge departure from what they'd previously been doing. We just didn't know about it. The second thing is the AOC thing, which is the idea that political figures can publish ads, and even if things are untrue in those ads, they will stay up. The caveat of that is that it has to be a quote from the political figure. So if AOC published an ad, it would have to be in quotes her saying something like, "My opponent euthanizes puppy dogs," end quote, and that would stay up on the platform. So it's just these fine lines that do not make sense to people. They're not intuitive. One of the core issues. And I think this is one of the most dangerous things. You mentioned Myanmar. I think this is one of the most dangerous things because I don't think when Zuckerberg is announcing this type of policy and talking about freedom of expression, I don't think that he's understanding the way a platform like his completely weaponizes that kind of policy and that ability of political figures to lie to people and use this for evil.
Now, Charlie Wardell at the New York Times noticed something that's really weird about this whole conversation. And that is that Facebook made something like $38 billion a year profit on sales of far more than $100 billion. And the political ad revenue that they get is relatively trivial. Why fight this fight? If in other areas of their business, they can be shown to be just sort of single-mindedly focused on growth and profit, this doesn't seem to be the business sector that's going to even fulfill that strategy.
Zuckerberg's answer to that, and it's up to you whether you believe him or not, but I don't understand any other justification for it, is really this kind of, I would say, democratic virtue in which he really thinks that there have been so many democratic causes, so many candidates, so many issues and parties that have been helped by the ability to use and leverage Facebook as a means of cheap advertising. So there was the representative from Guam, I thought, had a tremendous moment in which he said, "The one thing that I want to thank you for is for continuing to run political ads, because I could never have won my election, because I could never have afforded the TV clips or the radio clips. And everyone in my constituency is on Facebook and uses Facebook every day. And I was able to, for very little money, reach a lot of constituents and fund my entire campaign." So there's part of it that Zuckerberg isn't wrong. His platform is really helpful to a lot of democratic causes.
We ordinarily don't see or hear from Zuckerberg in the wild as much as we have in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, it's a huge change.
So the question is why? One thing might be that there's a lot of talk from Democratic candidates for the presidential nomination about antitrust action against Facebook. And now I think 47 state attorneys general have joined in an antitrust investigation into Facebook. Do you think his, freedom tour is related to that?
Yeah, I do. I think that there's a huge regulatory pressure happening right now in the U.S. It's been happening for a while in Europe, but it's definitely happening in the U.S. I think that is a response to that. Also, as I said before, when we were talking about that personal journey for him, it seems like he's grappling with what he has wrought.
Wait, are you suggesting introspection?
Yeah. Well, I mean, before he had the roundtables with conservatives that have been in the news lately, right, and have gotten him a lot of heat, he spent a long time having roundtables with tech experts, social psychologists, con law professors, all types of people. He's kind of, in a lot of senses, a precocious undergraduate. He's kind of frozen in the amber of dropping out of Harvard, and he has to educate himself. And I do think that there is a level of introspection into what he's doing. You know, and also he's getting called into Congress. He can't run away from the fact that there are real moments of public accountability that are happening.
The business of vetting for potential intrusion by hostile states was another Zuckerberg sighting this week when Facebook announced that they had taken down networks that were run by Iran and Russia. So there is indeed a lot going on, which leads me to, I think, my last question, which is, with this whole Zuckerberg-palooza, do we know more about him and about the company than we did, let's say, a month ago?
Not anything specific. We know nothing more really about Libra. We certainly don't know more about Facebook's origin story. I know less about free expression than I did before I watched the Zuckerberg speech. But I would say that what we do know is that they are susceptible and that there is an effect that public pressure is having on them, and that it's unclear yet how that's going to play out and whether it's going to result in self-regulation by them or whether it's going to result in real regulation in antitrust form or elsewhere.
Kate, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Kate Klonick is assistant professor at St. John's Law School, and she's researching the creation of an oversight board at Facebook.
Coming up, prison reform, a transpartisan issue.
This is On the Media.